So this talk is about trying to find aspects of topological behavior in different places than we normally look. So basically different places than DC transport. And I'm not going to try to cover all these papers in a short amount of time. And the first part will be maybe an introduction to topological phases in a way that some of you have already seen, I think. But what I want to build up to is trying to understand, are there effects in physical systems that might be quantized other than the ones we normally look at, which involve quanta like E over H and E squared over H. And in particular, if you just count powers, you can see the equation I've written, the one equation on the slide, you could have some three-dimensional current change that is related to two powers of the electric field and three powers of charge and two powers of H. So it isn't really what we started out looking for, but it's kind of what we stumbled on. So a lot of the talk will be, how did we wind up asking that question? And then at the end, a little bit of experimental evidence that maybe something like that is going on. Although we'll see that looking for quantization and things like that at finite frequency and gapless systems is a lot messier than looking in zero frequency in gap systems. And maybe a way to explain that, let me just start with two examples of quantization. One is well known and the other is maybe not as well known, to illustrate how things are going to be different in semi-metals, but potentially still interesting. And that is the beginning of the field of topological phases, I would say, was the discovery of the integer quantum Hall effect, which is this amazingly precise quantization of the Hall conductance, let's say. So if I measure a semiconductor in magnetic field, we often measure the current that builds up the voltage that builds up transverse to a current that we're running as a way to determine the density of carriers and whether they're electrons or holes and so on. And that usually gives you a straight line as a function of magnetic field, like in the bottom left of the plot. But as you increase the magnetic field in some two-dimensional systems, you see these amazingly flat plateaus on which what you measure is essentially fundamental constants E squared over H to about one part in a billion. And if you would like an older example, the AC Josephson effect basically measures E over H to comparable accuracy. So in this talk, most of what I have to say is going to be this kind of topological phase. It won't be fractional, but maybe there's another example that I find cute, which is not nearly as well quantized, but still the easiest way to measure the fine structure constant, at least if you have a friend who can give you a sheet of graphene. If you hold the graphene up to the light, you'll see that most of the light gets through, but about 2.3% gets blocked. And that is not some abbreviation of many decimal places. There are, it's not an exact result or nearly exact like the quantum Hall case, but it's good to 1% or so. That one layer of graphene attenuates pi times 1 over 137 of visible light. And that shows you that maybe something is possible in semi-metals at non-zero frequency. And I wouldn't call this effect very topological. And it's certainly not protected. If you went up to higher frequencies, it would be modified by the curvature of the bands in graphene, for example. But it does show that at least in some semi-metals, you might hope to see non-zero frequency quantized effects. So first, I'm going to talk mostly about vial semimetals. And as a warm-up, I started off with kind of a theoretical goal, looking for quantized nonlinear effects. But here are some reasons why you might care about vial semimetals and nonlinear optics, even if you don't care so much directly about topology. So one is, of course, that vial fermions, we currently believe, are not present in the standard model of particle physics. We thought maybe the neutrino was, but it has a mass, so it can't be. And I'll define what a vial semimetal is later on in the talk, but actually not for 20 minutes or so. But we do know that since 2014 or so, there are materials that have vial fermions as their low energy excitations, and they also have very interesting nonlinear optics. And that includes both the standard vial semimetal, the one that's most studied is tantalum arsenide. And that, I'll show some data later on, that has about the strongest fundamental nonlinear optical effect, the second harmonic generation of any material in a frequency regime that we care about. And then separately, the punchline of this talk is going to be that there's a different nonlinear optical effect in other vial semimetals, ones that are more chiral, that is not only strong, but more or less quantized, like in the graphene case. So not like in the quantum Hall case. And that happens for an interesting topological reason. And then linear optics maybe is very interesting and useful in vial semimetals, but it wouldn't give you this quantization in quite the same way. So you almost have to do nonlinear optics, at least if you want a sort of quantized signature of a vial point, which is what I want to build up to. So the way that we're going to get there is, you know, there are many ways at this point to look at topological materials and many approaches and that sort of thing. I want to focus on something which is measurable, which is electromagnetic response. And therefore, I want to focus on one theoretical approach, which I don't know, different people have different versions of topology and they like different things about them. The advantage of the Berry phase approach is that it arises very directly from when you sit down and try to calculate things like a conductivity. So I'll review that quickly, and then I'll talk about these new topological semimetals, which in a sense are three-dimensional versions of graphene from the point of view of electronic structure. And I'll talk a little bit about the pathway to why optical properties might be interesting there. And then I will talk a little bit about, at the end, about interaction physics, and maybe how, even if you didn't start with a vial semimetal, you could get there by running a current, say. So maybe a general question that I don't want to appear to be sweeping under the rug is, insulators having a gap is different from not having a gap in many fundamental ways. And it's a bit surprising actually that even gapless systems seem to have approximate quantization like in the graphene case. And I'll come back to that later on, but first let me remind you how it works in insulators, because that will be our starting point. And the work I'm gonna talk about is over a number of years and with a fairly large team of people, including a number of people who used to be at Berkeley and are now scattered around the world. That's the top row. The experiment I'll show is a collaboration of three groups in Dresden, Berkeley, and Temple. And then the projects at the end, I don't have photos, but these are the people currently at Berkeley, Vlad Kozy, Alex Avdoshkin, and Kazu Takasan. All right, so let me define a couple of words for people who don't normally think about optics, which was me until 10 years ago. So symmetry, let's say, tells us whether a response is allowed in a material. So Landau and Lifshitz is still correct as far as what symmetries are required to produce different responses. And in general, once a symmetry is broken that allows a response, you would expect the response to be there. So optically relevant symmetries, if I break inversion, then I can get second harmonic generation. If within breaking inversion, I'm polar, which I will take to mean I've got a definite vector in the crystal, then I could get things like a DC photocurrent from unpolarized light. And then a different subset of broken inversion materials are chiral, which means I've got no mirror symmetries. And that allows optical rotation like the Faraday effect, except without breaking time reversal. If you like, if I take chiral sugar molecules in water, I can get optical rotation, the rotation of the polarization of light in linear optics, even though it's certainly not a magnetic system. So if symmetry determines whether a response is there, then the geometry of wave functions and how that sometimes turns out to be topological, that's what can give us a magnitude that maybe is not caring very much about microscopic details and is even robust, we could hope, to disorder. And in some cases, topology has actually led to what one might think of as violations of a simple symmetry analysis. It might tell us that, for example, instead of just one possibility allowed by symmetry, there might be two. But usually when it comes down to actually measuring a response in a system, I think the old pictures are still valid. Okay, so the big question is, we certainly know and have known for a long time that some things about wave functions like Berry curvature do matter in the theory of metals. In fact, they're very important ingredients in even the semi-classical motion of electrons. So that I would say geometry of wave functions is established as important. Are there cases in metals where you can get something which is topological? So I already said that the answer is somewhat yes, if you're willing to be a little bit loose about the definition of topological. But I'll explain why that comes as a bit of a surprise, at least to me. But first, insulators. So the usual picture of order in a solid is through some kind of symmetry breaking. And maybe the one example, so I won't go through this slide in detail because this is a condensed matter audience, but magnetism, you should think of not just as picking out a direction in spin space, but also as breaking time reversal symmetry. And a lot of the recent developments in this area have been about understanding that time reversal symmetry is quite interesting at the quantum level. So the goal, the reason why I think you could care about quantization is that it's another kind of universality besides the kind of universality that I think made many of us want to be condensed matter physicists, which is the universality at second order phase transitions, which is the remarkable fact that if you're close enough to a critical point, say, the differences between the liquid gas phase diagram on the left and the phase diagram of a simple magnet on the right, those differences somehow don't matter if you ask certain questions. Like, for example, these critical exponents that determine the vanishing of the difference between two phases at one of these critical points. So that's saying that even though in doing Landau theory for phase transitions, we start with certainly a partial description, it winds up being exactly right because of universality. And that's what we also hope for in topological phases. So I'm going to give the picture due to Thouless of where the integer quantum Hall effect comes from very briefly. I don't think it will make a lot of sense, but now there are lots of review articles and things like that. But basically, I want to define a couple of gauge fields that live in the Brillouin zone of a good crystal. And then we now understand that a lot of things are expressible, or in fact, you couldn't understand if you don't understand these gauge fields. And that's been about a 40-year process, largely for insulators. But things have been happening with metals on the side, and I want to try to sort of bring these two together. So with insulators, I'm going to not go through this whole list. I'm just going to talk about the quantum Hall effect, the original example in Thouless's picture, and then talk about the magnetoelectric effect, which is maybe one of the more recent examples in insulators, because that's some practice for thinking about electromagnetic fields of the kind that I'll talk about in the main part on metals. So the two pictures on the right, one of them is the surface of the 3D topological insulator. And that, of course, was greatly aided by understanding that there are new topological invariants once you require time reversal symmetry of fermions. And then the second picture is an example of one Berry phase in optics. It's actually the circular photogalvanic effect that will be defined and be important later on, but at low frequencies. At low frequencies, it's a Berry phase effect, but it's not quantized. We think that at high frequencies, there is a sense in which it's quantized, or intermediate frequencies, I should say. Okay, so what are these gauge fields, A and F? The idea is that the adiabatic theorem you might learn or teach is only part of the story. The adiabatic theorem is if you start in a non-degenerate state and you change the Hamiltonian slowly, then you remain in that state to very high accuracy. The additional part is that if you bring the Hamiltonian around a closed loop in parameter space, and for us, the parameter is just going to be momentum, then you build up a measurable phase. And we write that phase as with notation that makes it look like a vector potential in momentum space. So for us, time dependence is not directly going to be the way we think about it, but the same mathematical object turns out to appear in many, very many places. And let me explain at least why we write it as a vector potential by saying what it has in common with the vector potential from electromagnetism. And that is that to define this A, I need to use reference wave functions. I need to choose some wave function at each point of parameter space. And you and I might choose different phases for that wave function. That's the only freedom if we are in a single non-degenerate state. So if you and I choose different phases, what happens to this vector potential? And the point is that it actually transforms just like the vector potential in E and M. It picks up a gradient of the phase change. And that means that A itself cannot be directly measurable at a point in momentum space, but the curl of A can. And that curl of A is called the Berry curvature. and it's just made out of the block states. So there are generalizations of these things to interactions and disorder, for the most part in insulators. With metals, the generalization to interactions and disorder is a lot harder, and I'm going to close with some comments about that. But for most of the talk, let's just talk about non-interacting electrons in a crystal, at least to get started, because often that turns out to be a useful starting point even for the real world. So down at the bottom, that formula, which was certainly a part of Thallus's 2016 Nobel Prize, is saying that if I integrate the Berry curvature, which is just the thing in parentheses at the bottom, over the two-dimensional Brillouin zone, then I can get an integer for each band, which is something like a winding number or topological invariant of that band. And that integer is physically meaningful. It tells me that if I put electrons in the band, that integer is how many units of Hall effect I get. That is, that integer multiplies E squared over H to make the measurable sigma XY. And that means that, you know, we might have thought all insulators are the same. Well, not really once I break time reversal, because there will be insulators that have non-trivial bands and insulators that have trivial bands, where non-trivial means that the integral of this Berry curvature, which is a topological invariant known to the mathematicians as Chern number. Chern spent a second part of his career at Berkeley. So that integer is actually not just topological, but physically meaningful. So there are continue to be new examples of topological phases. In recent years, they often depend on imposing additional symmetry. A neat one just discovered last year is the antiferromagnetic topological insulator phase in manganese bismuth telluride. But let me talk a little bit about physical responses other than just sigma XY, or actually what I'm going to talk about is something that is really connected to sigma XY, but in one higher dimension. And that is actually something that I think was first thought about by particle physicists. And it's an example of how maybe what we used to think about symmetry needs to be at least a little bit treated more cautiously now that we have topological invariants and things like that. So there's a short but very insightful paper by Wilczek called something like Axion Electrodynamics in Solids, which makes the point that there's something special about the E dot B term in the effective electromagnetic Lagrangian of a three-dimensional crystal. And it should be insulating if I'm going to measure it. You can measure that just by applying an electric field and measuring the magnetic moment, or by applying a magnetic field and measuring the electrical polarization. So terms like E dot B and E cross B and so on had been analyzed ever since the 1950s, primarily in the Soviet Union. And it was known that these happen in crystals when you break time reversal symmetry to allow magnetism and inversion symmetry to allow electric field. And Wilczek's point was that E dot B is a bit special because it is a total derivative of ADA, electromagnetic Chern Simons. And actually, as a result, its coefficient should really be thought of as an angle. That theta is only defined modulo 2 pi, at least if I'm talking about the bulk of a crystal. And then if I've got something which is odd under time reversal or odd under inversion, let's say it's odd under some symmetry, which means theta gets taken to minus theta, what angles are compatible with theta equal to minus theta? And the answer is, well, theta equal to 0 is equal to minus 0, but pi is equal to minus pi. So already in 87, Wilczek pointed out that there ought to be two kinds of time reversal invariant insulators. One that at least in bulk are theta equal to zero, and one that are theta equal to pi. And we now think of those as the ordinary and topological insulators in 3D. And aside from theory, one reason I wanted to mention it is that observing that theta angle was one of the more important optical experiments on topological insulators by several groups, including one at Johns Hopkins. So how is that connected with the standard definition you might have heard, which is that a 3D topological insulator is something with metallic surfaces, and more precisely, with surfaces that have an odd number of Dirac points. And the connection—
Sorry, Joel, can I stop and ask a question? Hi, sure. This is Aditi.
Hi.
So if I have any material where I break all the right symmetry so that I'm allowed to have E dot B, then generically I'll get a E dot B in the action, but the prefactor is going to be some number which is non-universal. Is that right?
That's right. So chromium sesquioxide is kind of the classic example.
And it's only when you have, So suppose I didn't know anything about a material, how do I know when I'll get something which is universal number times E dot B? Is it just by, like, I
I
mean,
would say, yeah, well, if you didn't have any information about symmetries, but you knew the number, it would be very fine-tuned for the number to be, let's say, for theta to be pi. So, for example, in chromium sesquioxide, it's roughly, I think, pi over 24, but only roughly. I mean, it's some number that we don't believe has any fundamental quantization. So, if you like, one thing we can do, although I think I took the slide out of my talk because it's a bit technical, if you give me any crystal, I can write down an expression for the orbital contribution to the magnetoelectric tensor, and I see that it has two parts, if you like. It's got sort of a geometric part and an ordinary part. And in that sense, it's different from the quantum Hall effect, which or polarization, which only have the geometric part. But if I have the symmetries, then the ordinary part has to be zero, and the geometric part has to be quantized. So that's saying this is more like electrical polarization in that it's non-zero in general whenever the symmetries allow it to be non-zero. When I have symmetries, then there are only particular values it can take. But it was actually measured. Well, before we knew, or okay, I guess it was only measured carefully probably after 1987, but I'm not sure if those authors knew about the idea that it might be pi. Anyway, it's definitely not pi in chromium sesquioxide.
okay, thanks.
Great, thank you for the question. So, the way it works is that that odd number of Dirac points at the surface, if I could apply a little bit of magnetic field to gap them, that gives me a half integer sigma xy. That's how. That's actually something we know from studying graphene, and I'll maybe show that in a second. But the way that connects to bulk E dot B, well, bulk E dot B, I said that's a total derivative of ADA in electromagnetic terms. ADA, that's the Chern-Simons term, that's how we describe the electromagnetic effect of having a surface quantum Hall layer. So to say that a material has theta equal to pi in bulk is equivalent through a sort of high school integration by parts to saying that it has a surface state that carries the quantum Hall effect. It doesn't necessarily need to be a surface state that's decoupled from the bulk, but there is some current flow at the surface with a magnitude determined by theta, plus possibly some integer part, for example, if I were to imagine adding integer quantum Hall layers to the surface. So the way we know that an odd number of Dirac fermions will indeed give us a half integer Hall effect, at least in experimental way, is by studies of graphene. So this is from Philip Kim's group when he was at Columbia. And what it shows is that the integer Hall plateaus in graphene follow a unusual pattern. They don't go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 times E squared over H. They go minus 6, minus 2, 2, 6, 10, 14, et cetera, times E squared over H. And that's because there are four, in a sense, Dirac points in graphene, two for spin and two for K and K prime. And then once we divide these by four, we get exactly the half integers. So one Dirac cone should give us one half integer. So to kind of show one last formula in the insulating case, which I think is the most mathematically complicated thing I might talk about, the top couple of lines are about electromagnetism and about what you might actually measure. But this does give you a new formula for the band structure contribution, which is harder to actually calculate with maybe than the earlier formulas, but is very beautiful, which is, I think, the first appearance of the non-abelian part of the Berry connection. You can make a Chern-Simons form out of that and use it to compute the theta angle. And again, this is a piece in all crystals. So in a sense, even if you measure in some old-fashioned crystal like CR203, if you measure the theta angle, it has a piece which is from the non-abelian Berry gauge fields, even though it's not the dominant piece. So that's all saying that in insulators, there are electromagnetic responses, including ones involving two fields, E and B. And we understand a lot about them. I think I'll skip over this, but this was that comment that there in the Chern-Simons form, it's actually the non-abelian part of the Berry connection that matters. And that just means the generalization of the Berry curvature I wrote down before to include the possibility of multiple bands. So for example, either I've got degenerate bands, or if all my bands are occupied and I'm not making transitions, it probably might not matter what their energy differences are.
Joe?
Yes.
Hey, hi, quick question. I think it's continuation of Aditya. So This is kind of a surface contribution, right? So if you make a sample thicker, this will not change. But the bulk value, if there is anything coming from lack of symmetries in the bulk, will accumulate, right?
Not really. I mean, it really has, because of this total derivative aspect. So I think the way to think about it is that it's very much like electrical polarization of a crystal that breaks inversion. So we can express electrical polarization as either a dipole moment density in bulk or a surface charge density. And those have the same units. And if I make it bigger, I don't actually build up more surface charge density.
Okay, so it's not rotation of the polarization plane as in sugar.
So E dot B will give me that's right. So in bulk, it does not build up rotation of the polarization plane.
E dot B, I understand that E dot B will not do it. But if there's lack of, if there is a non-geometrical term, are you saying that non-geometrical terms also do not build up?
If they're still E dot B, they still do not build up. There are other terms that will build up. So for example, the reason why a lot of experiments work well in chromium sesquioxide is that it has a lot of additional symmetries that keep you from having like Faraday effect that scales. So I'll take your question to be, you're right that if I had a generic magnetic material and I knew nothing else, then there would likely be a Faraday effect that would build up the thickness of the material. But in the materials that only have E dot B, there is not such a Faraday effect that builds up linearly.
And last part of this question. So if it's basically surface effect, the symmetry of surface is different from symmetry of the bulk. So when you're saying that symmetry protects you, which symmetry does protect you?
So the idea is what I'm assuming is that at the bulk, and again, electrical polarization is kind of an analogy where, but let me just talk about it for this case. What I'm assuming is that whatever I do at the surface, I can add sigma xy that is an integer, but I couldn't add a sigma xy that is not an integer because we think that a gapped system at the surface.
Okay, I see.
But I assume that I've gapped the surface, which means the surface is only ambiguous by an integer.
All right, cool. So, okay, thanks. Yeah, that helps.
Joel, could I ask if what you're saying is not equivalent to saying that if the magnetoelectric tensor in the bulk is proportional to an identity matrix, then it's a purely surface term and not otherwise. You only see the surface effect only independent of the size of the system if the magnetoelectric tensor is identity.
I think I'm confident in that one way, that if it is the identity in these coordinates of E and B, then I will only see a surface effect. I haven't thought about exactly what else might only give you a surface effect.
Chromium oxide, it's diagonal, but not identity.
Exactly. I thought it was diagonal, but not quantized, but maybe we can compare notes later. Okay, so let me now, so one last note on all of this stuff about the magnetoelectric effect turns out to be like a higher dimensional generalization of the so-called modern theory of polarization. And in fact, there's a clue in the theory of polarization that there should be something very special about dp by db, that is the polarization induced by a magnetic field. And the clue is the following. When people talk about the polarization of a crystal coming from the bulk, they think of that as ambiguous because I can't really control what goes on at the surface. And in particular, I could add an integer number of surface charges per unit cell, and that wouldn't modify the bulk at all. So that's a polarization of quantum or ambiguity of electric charge per transverse unit cell area, which is a messy thing that I've called omega. But that messy thing also appears when I ask about what is the magnetic field I can apply to the crystal and still have the same unit cell. If you want the flux quantum for a unit cell is H over E omega, and omega drops out in the ratio of those. So dp by dB has a natural quantum is what this is saying, which you could also get by, power counting if you wanted, but it's just E squared over H. So this slide is kind of motivation for the end. We have a lot of quanta. but they seem to be mostly either E over H quanta, like things related to the flux quantum, or E squared over H quanta, which can be a contact resistance, you know, in 1D. It can be the Hall conductance in 2D, or this is all saying it can be the magnetoelectric polarizability in 3D. But that's really because the magnetoelectric polarizability in this E dot B sense is closely related to the Hall conductance in 2D. So E squared over H is everywhere. And with that, now we move on to metals. And I will try to get through all that I have remaining in 25 minutes or so, and I appreciate the questions. So what I want to say now is you might have guessed from things I've already said that even in metals, the Berry curvature and Berry connection might be important because they have something to do with where electrons sit. So the intuitive idea would be, I've already mentioned that polarization involves A, the Berry connection, the work of people like David Vanderbilt. So polarization is certainly related to where electrons sit. And if I change the polarization, I have to move electrons. So that's polarization in general is not quantized. It's some physical observable, but it does involve the Berry phase. And it's made from the wave functions through this Berry curvature. So why might we expect something like this to matter in the theory of solids and for things like polarization? I think the intuition is the following. Suppose I gave you the band structure of a material, and let's say you knew the material wasn't magnetic. Could you look at the band structure and tell whether the material broke inversion or not? And the answer is no, because time reversal is enough to guarantee that E of K is equal to E of minus K. So the band structure will have inversion symmetry even if the material doesn't, which means that, well, there's still physics in that material that is sensitive to the inversion breaking, but it has to involve the wave functions, not just the energy as a function of K. And that means that there must be things I can make out of the wave function. And one example is the Berry phase, and I'll tell you another example in a second. But some ingredients of the wave function actually have to matter at low energy in inversion broken materials because the band structure wouldn't let us get anything that depends on the inversion breaking like polarization. And the specific example that I think students should all be getting in classes now is the anomalous velocity first discussed by Karplus and Luttinger, which is an extra term in the equations of motion of a wave packet in a metal. And the F here involves the same, it's the same Berry curvature I talked about before. So if you want, you could think of F as dA by dK multiplying dK by dT. And what that term means, it's an extra contribution to the velocity. And the first term on the right-hand side, even that turns out to be more settled than I thought a few years ago, but that group velocity is something that the electron would have even if it were a point particle. And the anomalous velocity is something that it has because it's not a point particle. Suppose that at 1k, the electron is sitting on atom A, and then at a different k, it's sitting on atom B. Then if k is changing, the electron wave function is shifting from atom A to atom B, and you'd expect that to give you an extra piece of the velocity. And that's this anomalous velocity. It's like the velocity within the unit cell is something that Duncan Halding likes to call it, I believe. So I'll give you the classic example of why this was historically thought up and then why it's hard. And then I'll talk about optical effects. So let me talk about the original example of wave function geometry in metals and try to give a sense of why metals are just harder than insulators, even if that semi-classical equation of motion is a good start. So the idea is, this is from a review article by several people, including Naoto Nagaosa, on if you take a magnetic metal like iron and try to measure sigma xy, will you get a part that is like what we wrote down for insulators? So that integral at the bottom is an integral now, instead of being over the whole band, it's just over the Fermi C. And I integrate the Berry curvature, and I get a contribution of sigma xy, but that contribution is sometimes hard to measure. It may not always be the dominant contribution. And in fact, the current belief based on experiments is that if the system is very clean, then sigma xy is actually dominated by Fermi surface effects and the details of scattering, what we might call extrinsic. And of course, if the material is very dirty, then localization, hopping type physics, things like that are important. But there seems to be some intermediate range of conductivities where this is the dominant term, the so-called intrinsic contribution to the anomalous Hall effect. But that shows why this is maybe not straightforward. It seems like it is the dominant effect, but I don't think we know exactly how close its magnitude is to what's predicted by this intrinsic term. And part of that is you can find versions of disorder where if you carefully calculate what is the sigma xy you would measure, you can get zero, so which is not what this formula would give you. So I'll give you my own intuition for why there's something right about this term is to take a filled band, so an insulator that would have quantized sigma xy, and then put a few holes in it, or just lower the Fermi level slightly from filling the band, then I wouldn't expect sigma xy to jump discontinuously to zero, because that's not usually the way physics works, at least in experiments. So you could view this as sort of a remnant of a filled band, at least in that limit. I think it's intuitive why such a term should exist. But as I mentioned, it's pretty hard to rigorously prove that there is a realistic disorder model where this is the dominant term. There has been a lot of work that's gone into that, though. Partly motivated by that, about 10 years ago, and motivated by an expert on optics that I work with a lot, Joe Orenstein, we tried to think about other Berry phase effects where it might be easier to separate out the Berry phase contribution from ordinary contributions. And we thought about the following low frequency effect where maybe the ordinary contributions are likely to cancel. It's called the circular photogalvanic effect. And what that means is take, let's say, low frequency like terahertz light that is circularly polarized. So statically, in just semi-classical transport, the point of the picture is that if the electron ground state was the black circle, the electric field will push the electrons over a bit and they'll reach some kind of equilibrium, which is the gray circle. And then circular polarization means that at low frequency, the gray circle will make a circle around the black circle. And the ordinary velocity averages to zero in that process. But if you have the right low symmetry crystal, then the anomalous velocity does not. It winds up being like the anomalous Hall effect. You don't need a magnetic material if you like the T-breaking is coming from the circular polarization, but you can pull out something related to the Berry phase of the crystal. And we still think that is likely to be what's going on in a lot of classic old experiments on this effect led by a group in Regensburg. But it would be like the anomalous Hall effect. There wouldn't be any quantization. So I'm gonna come back to this effect later on because we came back to it about 8 years after we were first interested. But first, I want to say a quick word about linear optics, because that might be where you would start if you were going to look for something optical in Weyl semimetals. And it turns out that optical rotation winds up giving you an interesting effect. I need to define what a Weyl semimetal is first, and it involves another low frequency ingredient in the theory of metals. And this linear optics, I am going to skip through it pretty quickly, actually. I know there are people on the call who are very expert in this area, so I'm sorry for running through it very rapidly. First, what is a Weyl semimetal? I'm going to spend more of my time on the nonlinear aspects is what I'm saying. So very soon after Dirac wrote down the 4x4 Dirac equation, two people realized two different ways to split it into two by two pieces. One was Majorana, which gets a lot of attention these days, and the other was Weyl, which also gets a lot of attention these days. And the idea that Weyl had was if your particle has zero mass, then it's always relativistic. There's no way to catch up with it. And that means that its helicity is invariant. Your particle is either always right-handed or always left-handed. And those are the two by two pieces. So as I mentioned in the introduction, that doesn't seem to happen for fundamental particles in nature, but it does seem to happen for the electrons in tantalum arsenide, and now a number of other materials. So they're handed electrons in 3D. And if you want, Dirac and Weyl materials are two equally valid ways to generalize graphene to 3D. The Weyl case has lower symmetry. You need to break either inversion or time reversal in order to split the four-band cone into two-band cones. And then a recent that actually has an old history. In fact, Conyers-Herring's PhD thesis was on looking for Weyl semimetals. But topology did add something important to the game, which is that these Weyl points If I made a little sphere around one of them and calculated the Berry flux through the sphere, I'd get an integer. So it's like saying they have a topological charge. The total topological charge of all the vowel points in a crystal is zero. But if I've got low enough symmetry, then it could be that, say, the positive vowel point and the negative vowel point are at different energies. And that does happen. It doesn't happen in tantalum arsenide, but it does happen in, for example, rhodium silicide. But the way, of course, that we now try to deduce that materials are vowel submetals involve this topological aspect and its connection to surface states. So there are lots of neat experiments involving surface states. One is by James Analytis at Berkeley, for example, that I think showed that these have transport consequences. I'm going to focus on bulk and ask, you know, like with topological insulators or the quantum Hall effect, what would you look for? And then this is the graphene example I mentioned at the beginning. Are there things analogous to this? So where you would start is maybe something that the particle physicists had thought about, which is the uniqueness of vowel fermions. At least part of their uniqueness is that if you just had one of them, you would violate charge conservation. If you applied the same parallel E and B fields, you would have a so-called chiral anomaly and create charge. So fortunately, the total charge of the vowel points in a crystal is zero, so we can't spontaneously make electrons. I don't know whether that's fortunate or unfortunate, but charge is still conserved in solids. But there are still interesting possibilities. And the way that if you actually put in dimensionful units in the top equation, a way to think about where we're going is that we can generate a two-dimensional current density from electric field and E squared over H. We can create a change in time of a three-dimensional current density by adding an extra little e, big E over H. And I'm not talking about indices and so on, but that's kind of a clue that you could either go to E dot B or E squared and look for things in 3D. So E dot B, there are transport experiments. I think a problem is that there are other contributions to E dot B. And so far the transport experiments maybe don't look exactly like theoretical models, but I think that's a worthwhile direction. But I'm going to focus on effects that are more E squared. But first, the linear part that I said I would mention quickly, it was thought or hoped maybe that you know you could find a material where the symmetries of the crystal would play the role of the electric field in the chiral anomaly. And in a sense, you would have a response just to magnetic field. And that's true. It's not true at equilibrium, but it is true if you have an oscillating magnetic field. But then you basically have an electromagnetic wave and you wind up computing the linear response to an electromagnetic wave, which is optical rotation in a chiral material, kind of an old problem. But it turns out that at low frequency, there is something maybe new in the theory of metals that shows up. I think there's a consensus that the low frequency optical rotation in a chiral metal or semi-metal is given by this integral at the bottom. And the Fermi velocity appears in the integrand, and so does the orbital magnetic moment of block electrons. And it turns out that this formula, we had 8 pages of supplemental information in our material during the quantum calculation. You can do it in about 3 lines semi-classically. And the only thing you need to realize, so this is sometimes called gyrotropy, sometimes called natural optical activity. It's the fact that materials like quartz or selenium just rotate light because they're handed, not because they're magnetic. The only thing you need to know is the equation in the middle of this slide, which is that if you have orbital magnetic moments in a material, which even non-magnetic materials can, then there's an extra contribution, not the anomalous velocity, but for the group velocity in a magnetic field, which is just the fact that you've got an orbital magnetic moment that depends on K, and that gets dotted into your applied B field. So this modification of the group velocity is everything you need to get that formula I wrote down a moment ago. And the something that confused us for a while is that the orbital magnetic moment is very, very close to the Berry curvature. It only differs, if you like, in that it's got an extra Hamiltonian sandwiched in the top line. So incidentally, this, if you want to put this in a more general picture, optical rotation is the order Q expansion of conductivity. We actually just wrote a paper on the order Q squared for people who have an interest in linear response. But now, the highlight, nonlinear response. And basically, I'm going to go back to that circular photogalvanic effect and argue that all the material dependent aspects in principle drop out if you've got positive and negative vowel notes split by energy over some range of frequencies. So the idea is that from what I said before, linear response, even if you took the simplest model of a vowel semimetal, you would still have things like the energy difference between the vowel points showing up in linear response. So what about nonlinear optics? So first, this is the experiment showing that vowel semimetals can have really strong nonlinear optical properties. This is by Joe Orenstein. This is tantalum arsenide from a few years ago. And the main point is in the table, if you look at the intrinsic strength of nonlinear effects in tantalum arsenide, it is at least 10 times larger. And if you go a little bit lower in frequency, even larger than that compared to all the benchmark frequency doubling crystals. Whether you can use it is challenging because it is a semi-metal, which means it's a bit lossy, but it is interesting that this material seems to be very, very strongly polar as defined in this response. And if anyone is curious, I could say a little bit at the end about why, where we think this comes from. I don't think there's yet a consensus on that. We have our own picture. But what I want to focus is on something that we do understand, I think more theoretically, which is the following. So I'm going to go back to that circular photogalvanic effect. And let me give you just a picture of how you might measure only, say, the positive vowel point, but not the negative vowel point, if you had a crystal where the positive and negative are at different energies. So I want to think at finite frequency, because the magic is going to happen when I've got optical transitions that go from the lower part of the cone or the lower cone to the upper cone. So if I look at this picture, for the left vowel point, with the Fermi level where it's shown, or chemical potential where it's shown, I've got optical transitions across the left vowel point. On the right side, I don't have transitions across the vowel point because they're polyblocked. The final state is occupied. But I will still have some transitions on the right, but they're kind of in the intraband limit, which is what we analyzed back in 2010. And we know that those are quite weak. So the question is, what do you get from what's on the left, which is the current injection from transitions across a vowel point. And here you're basically taking, it's a little bit like what Fallis et al. Did with the Kubo formula. You're taking a standard perturbation theory expression for optical response and massaging it into a topological form. And the key thing to note is that even though the transition is involving states that are not at the vowel point, they still know that the vowel point is there. That's what's topological. For example, I couldn't open up a gap at the vowel point, just one vowel point has some topological stability, which means it has to show up in the states just above and below it. And in the mathematically, the way that shows up is that this Berry curvature through the sphere around the point remains quantized until I hit the other vowel point. So what you get, and this is the top line, and I'll quickly sketch some of the relevant history. The rate at which you inject current that is sensitive to whether the polarization is right or left circular is fundamental constants, in particular E cubed over H squared, times the intensity of the alight, times the charge of the vowel point. And this is for a clean crystal, and it's for one vowel point, but we know the contribution from the other vowel point is small by a factor of 100 or so. So that's what that has to do with reality, I'll come back to in a second. I'll talk about interactions, and we have worked a bit on disorder as well, as of other people. But following this prediction, Zahid Hassan's group found a vial material that has the right symmetries and a pretty large gap of about 0.7 EV between the positive and negative vial points, effectively. It also has a nice factor of 4 enhancement because it's kind of a multifold vial point. And there was a theory paper. I'm not on the paper on the bottom either, but it's very nice as far as saying before the experiment, these are the energies where you will actually see this quantized circular photogalvanic effect in rhodium silicide. So I think I'll skip over other pictures for where the quantization comes from, because maybe the key thing is it doesn't actually care about band bending or anisotropy or so on. It is at the one electron level topological, but it's not as robust to disorder. And I'll show at the end that it's not as robust to interactions, but whatever your favorite way is of estimating nonlinear optics, you can apply it to this and they all give the same answer. So now the experiment, which is now published in Science Advances. So the idea is, this is all optical. you are generating a little burst of current into the material. And the prediction from the theory is that from lowish frequencies, at least not so low that you're spoiled by disorder, but over some range of frequencies, you ought to get a response from just one vowel point. And then at about 0.7 EV, that gets canceled by transitions across the other vowel points of opposite charge. So in this experiment, it's hard to get an absolute magnitude, but you can get a frequency dependence, and it does fall off rapidly. And here, I'm not an expert on nonlinear optics, but people like Torchinsky and Orenstein tell me that this is an unusual pattern of nonlinear of photocurrent to depend on photon energy, where it's large for a while, and then it suddenly falls off to relatively close to zero. So as I said, the overall magnitude here is not a measure, you know, can't really be measured because you're putting a burst of current into the material and trying to figure out from its radiation how strong it was. So there are large uncertainties in that. It is relatively large. I think that's what Joe is prepared to say. But you do see what looks like, at least to my eyes, a pretty strong drop off where it's supposed to drop off. So I would say at least they are measuring one vial point being canceled by the other. As I mentioned, the magnitude is an open question, and it's the last question I want to talk about. So here, this is the work with Alex and Vlad. The first step was, so this is to try to understand, do interactions modify that? Because we know in graphene, something quite interesting happens. That's the line at the bottom. If you ask about that linear quantization in graphene, you find, and it took a number of groups a number of years to work this out, that there is an interaction correction, but it's anomalously small or fortuitously small. You would expect the correction to be of order unity. The correction is actually about 1% because 19 minus 6 pi divided by 12 is about 1%. So I don't think, I mean, maybe I saw Leonid's on the call. Maybe someone can correct me, but I don't understand any deep reason why the correction is small. To me, it's just small because this number is small in graphene. So now we're doing a fairly, you know, complicated calculation of the nonlinear effect. So you kind of set that up like a particle physicist would. You've got perfectly linear cones, and you calculate the different corrections at leading order. And the leading correction, so the self-energy doesn't really do anything except shift the frequency range. The vertex correction does modify the effect by an amount that we don't think is particularly small. So we get a coefficient which is not 1%, and what it multiplies is the effective fine structure constant using the velocity of the Dirac cone, which is also not particularly small. And it has a frequency dependence that we hope might be visible. So we think that there ought to be, you know, I think in further analysis of these photocurrent experiments, it might be possible to determine what are the band structure corrections from the other point, say, the other vowel point, and what are the interaction corrections and try to separate those out. So that's our current belief of what's likely to be there in the experiment. So it's in the graphene case, the corrections are small by luck. In the chiral anomaly case, the corrections are small for deep reasons. Here, as far as we can tell from our calculation, they're not incredibly small. And then the last thing, which I think I will skip, except to say that there are some really neat experiments out there. We wrote a theory paper on this idea, and then we found out that people were already doing the experiment. If you start with the Dirac material, you can try to turn it into a vial by running a current to break time reversal and inversion. And that lets you generate various nonlinear optical effects in kind of a controlled way, controlled by the amount of current you run. And in particular, cadmium arsenide is claimed to have a really, really long relaxation time, almost so long it's hard to believe. And if that's true, then you can make this effect work and be very strong. And we proposed that, but I think people at Los Alamos had already figured out this was a good experiment to do, and hopefully they will write up their results soon. So that's what I wanted to say. And where I think I will wrap up as summary is to say, I think that finite frequency, you know, here, this is something that is, again, like the graphene linear optics, only approximately quantized in some range of frequencies that are large enough that you aren't destroyed by disorder and small enough that you don't hit the other vowel point or the top of the band or something like that. But in that range, there is a nonlinear optical effect that is fundamentally set by E cubed over H squared. And I like that because I think it's an addition to the list of quanta in electromagnetic response and topological phases, and it is pretty different from the others. It's different from the E over H quanta, and it's different from the E squared over H quanta. So in general, I would say with vowel semimetals, I think there's a lot of justified excitement. There are also analogs that you could make from spins or from other excitations that might be more strongly interacting. But at least with from what we can say, you shouldn't just look at the ordinary DC probes. Obviously, there's interesting thermal stuff as well that I you know, would love to talk about, but can't say. But nonlinear optics seems to be both really unique in the sense of strong and really unique in the sense of having this fundamental scale. So that's one direction that we intend to keep working on. All right, so I think I'll stop there. Thank you all for sticking around.
Thank you. thanks for a nice talk. I think we asked a number of questions, but okay, there's one question from Tom.
Hello, I have one question. Can you go back to your slide with the triangle diagram?
Yes.
Thank you. So in this case, you're saying that the calculation depends on the cutoff frequency. And well, the thing that I'm worried is that maybe if the cutoff is like in the order of the different energy between two cones, then I don't know how it can have a good conclusion about the result.
I guess, you know, for the cutoff, if you put in a value, okay. I think that it would be hard for it to be other than some electron volt type scale, the way we're doing it. So like, I don't see any argument for any other scale. And it, yeah, that will modify the numerical factor, but I don't think by enough to make it, you know, much smaller than one or much greater than one. So that's all I can say, I guess, at this point.
So, I mean, basically you're saying that the Dirac cone is approximation, then, well, at higher level, at higher energy, then you have like different dispersion, then it definitely will affect your sorry, diagram. And I mean that if at the energy is larger than the different energy between two cones, then it will definitely affect the result of your calculation.
I'm not sure I'm following. So the it's only the linear effect that disappears once the, okay, I mean, maybe we can talk about the calculation in more detail offline, but I think there is a frequency dependence, but I don't think there's any reason to believe it's, you know, divergent or pathological. I think it actually is less pathological than the graphene case, the way I understand it, at least. So yeah, maybe, I guess I don't think that there is any uncertainty in the physical magnitude that one would measure. So should I see there's a question in the chat. So
yep. The question is, how is CPG affected by multiple vial points?
Yeah, so it is sensitive to whether the charge is positive or negative. So like positive, it can get canceled by negative. If I got multiple positive points at the same energy, say, then the effect basically adds. So, okay, the nonlinear, okay, so I can't, the only calculation of interactions we've done on this slide is the two vowel point, but the general case, we can at least do the non-interacting calculation. And then, so every vowel point I cross gives E cubed over H squared, basically, times the vowel charge of that point. So as transitions become allowed or disallowed, I get shifts by integers, and then I get the additional sort of small parts. And there's a paper by Ivchenko and Golub on sort of how they fit together, maybe. But yeah, I mean, multiple points are not that hard to treat at the non-interacting level, and at the interacting level, I don't know if there's any, I mean, at higher order, you might expect processes involving three points or something. We didn't even try to calculate this.
Okay. Actually, I have a quick question. So for this rhodium silicon system, is there any special reason why contribution from other bands is particularly small? Is it an accident, or there are some fundamental reasons for that?
I think there is kind of a fundamental reason why if you want, the low frequency semi-classical effect is small. And that goes back to this kind of 2010 paper where, okay, so a way to put it is that it's a dimensionless measure of how far you shifted away from inversion symmetry. And that usually is much less than one. So the part of the Berry phase that winds up controlling the effect at low, so in other words, this is something that you can basically calculate semi-classically. And what shows up is in the anomalous velocity term, how large is that? And it seems that the anomalous velocity term in all the crystals I know about, and we did some explicit calculations, I don't know an example where the dimensionless strength of the Berry curvature there, where this is coming from inversion breaking, not T breaking, it always seems to be much less than one. So in that sense, rhodium silicide and, you know, gallium arsenide is the one that we calculated in great detail, different kinds of wells, which gallium arsenide also breaks inversion. It seems like in a sense, inversion breaking is not of order one. Actually, maybe that's another statement about, you know, why nonlinear optical effects here, you know, nonlinear optical effects tend to be weak in a sense, even in, you know, the standard frequency doublers, barium titanate or whatever. I think inversion breaking is usually not of order unity, is I guess our understanding of why the semi-classical part is small compared to the, well, at a vowel point, in a sense, things are quantized, so of order one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I see the question in the chat. Yes, that's right. If a vowel metal, well, okay. It depends on whether that, okay, the question is, so you mean that if a vowel metal has two vowel points of opposite charges, then non-interacting CpG cancels out. That's what depends on frequency. So if I look at this picture, it wouldn't cancel out at this omega because I've only got transitions across one vowel point that are allowed and the other one are polyblocked. But if I increased the frequency so that transitions across both the points are allowed, so in other words, at high enough frequencies that every vowel point has transitions across it, then it cancels out. But if the vowel points are at different energies, then I can have frequencies and chemical potentials where I only get some and not others. And that's when it doesn't cancel out. So in the experiment here, this is saying that the two vowel points are not canceling each other out up to 0.7, because that's when I only expect to have transitions across one. And then they are canceling out for energies above 0.7.
So hi Joel, in this experimental plot, what is being exactly measured?
So they're measuring the radiation so they're sending in a intense pulse of light. And that light generates a little burst of current into the material because this is a photocurrent. And then they don't have contacts. They measure the radiation from that little burst of light into the little burst of current into the material. So your input signal is with a laser at some high frequency. And what you get out is rectified in a sense. It has a frequency that is associated with the pulse length of the incident light. So you're putting in light at, say, you know, 0.7 eV, and you're getting out light in the terahertz, and the integrated intensity of the light coming out is basically what you're measuring. Now,
would this quantized response, almost quantized response, be maintained in the steady state if you keep shining the light?
No. Unfortunately, no, because what's really quantized, and this is kind of forced on us by the way the units work, is dj by dt. It's not j. So if you can do it, one reason for doing it with these short pulse experiments, and even in this experiment, the relaxation time is pretty fast. So it'd be nicer to have a better crystal than rhodium silicide. The idea is that the rate at which I make current appear is quantized, but steady state, that will reach some equilibrium with relaxation in the crystal. So it will, what I'll measure for steady state j will depend on tau. So if you can measure the rise of current, then you could see the quantum. Otherwise, you need to measure tau by some other means.
Okay.
Can I make a short comment and hear your answer? So basically, it's nonlinear in the same sense. It's measuring decay or just absorption of light. It's proportional to the intensity of the light. It's just you measure not absorption, but the DC current.
I would say there's, okay. To me, absorption, like in the graphene case, is a linear optical effect.
Well, in Fermi's golden rule, you calculate something photonic in the field, right?
Yeah, that's right. No, in fact, that's actually the next slide.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what you calculate here. You just calculate some other quantity. You multiply it by additional velocities, that's all.
That's right. And the interesting thing is that even if you bent so that there wasn't a single velocity, you still get the same answer. But if you want, yes, I skipped over this slide, but I do think the simplest way to understand why this quantum comes out is to take the linear response conductivity and then say that the current you inject, every transition has a change in velocity of, you know, 2 VF.
Right, which is a beautiful thing. I mean, that's easy to understand.
May I ask, Joel, so is it something like this? You have absorption of photons that causes interband transitions. Interband transitions causes change of intra-unit cell polarization. And so you get this current, you know, there is current which is time derivative of polarization, right, in Maxwell's thing. So because you're making transitions, you have your polarization is time dependent. And so that is interpreted as current. So does this formula on this slide, something along those lines?
I think it's even simpler. I mean, I think it is just ordinary injection current, which means you are changing the momentum of the electron because it's making the velocity, let's say, not the momentum. Mm-hmm. The momentum, mm-hmm. You're making a vertical transition across the vowel point. Mm-hmm. So if you want, the velocity is changing because I went from one cone, you know, the bottom cone to the top. So I think I think it's a current that is a real current in the sense of velocity of moving electrons, not just the polarization current.
Okay. So you cause interband transitions and that changes velocity of the electrons. So that causes current,
yep.
Right? And Fermi-Golden rule tells you that just keeps going linearly in time. That's why you have time derivative of current.
Exactly. So this is the Fermi's golden rule calculation if you want it. So as I mentioned, whatever your favorite way is of calculating optical transitions, I think you can plug in the vowel point and you will get the sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Joel, is this quantized result in the non-interaction case is independent of the distance of the Fermi energy to the wild point? Does it not use the linearity of the dispersion?
That's right. So, if I just have one vowel point and I could ignore the other vowel point in its bands, which will give some small, this kind of semi-classical correction, then yes, I can basically transform. So for example, that the previous slide, this would, I think, depend on linearization, the way I think about it. But actually, if I calculate, I can, even without linearization, I can transform the integral over initial and final states into something that is the Berry flux, and therefore it's quantized.
I see.
There is a question from Bert. The question is, why is there only one sign of velocity when you excite the electron?
So I guess the way that the polarization of the light matters, so I've got right circular and left circular light, and those create a difference as far as which optical transitions they make across the vowel point. So I think that's where it's really the difference in current injection between right circular and left circular. That's what picks out one sign of the velocity in my picture. Okay, so it is optical transition elements, but that's the kind of top line here is that they are coupling to the Vx plus Iy and Vx minus Iy combinations. And that's why I get that's why it doesn't cancel.
Is there any other question from the audience?
Yeah, I have a question.
Go ahead.
From another viewpoint, we have two quantum systems, say light and then matter. And then we let them to interact with each other. After interaction, we have considered light completely classical, but it seems that we have considered an observable in the material which is corresponding to the angular momentum of light, and we consider it quantized. Isn't it inconsistent?
I don't think so. And the same question comes up when, for example, you use the photons of light, circularly polarized light, to pump spin in gallium arsenide. So maybe there are two answers. One is that if you've got a large crystal that you're thinking of as static, then angular momentum is not a perfect quantum number for a general band structure. But I think, you know, if I'm making a simple picture, the circular polarization of the light that had angular momentum in it, and that got transferred in this process of generating a photocurrent. So the photon was absorbed and it transferred its angular momentum to the crystal. I think that's where it went, if you like.
Okay, so I don't see any more questions. So I'd like to thank Joel for a great talk today. And I think this concludes today's seminar. Then we'll see you next week. Thank you very much.